from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There's a shift going on in the economy, and we're struggling to find a way to describe it. We fall back on this, an Uber for fill in the blank, as in an Uber for flowers, an Uber for your laundry, for meals, cocktails, parking, massage. In startup Mecca San Francisco and beyond, on-demand, on-your-smartphone services are proliferating. They're more than nifty concierge apps. They're challenging old business models and the way we work and live. This hour on Point, the Uber for everything economy. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you in it, of it? Are you being waited on hand and foot in the on-demand economy? Do you want to be? Are you working in there? How is it? Are you driving for Uber or one of the others? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. How big are Uber's ambitions? Where here's co-founder and CEO Travis Kalanick describing Uber's mission at the Digital Life Design Conference in Munich earlier this year.
The way we look at what we do is we are the cheapest reliable ride always. And the key there is reliable, because you can always have a cheap ride. You can sell a ride for half as much. But if you can't get one, it doesn't really matter. Our mission, we like to say, is transportation as reliable as running water everywhere for everyone.
Transportation as reliable for running water everywhere for everyone. And the Uber model is one that people are looking to bring to all kinds of services all over the world. Joining me first today from San Francisco is Johanna Buya, reporter for BuzzFeed News. She's written extensively on the on-demand economy. You can find a link to her reporting at our website, onpointradio.org. Johanna, welcome to On Point. Thank you for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So how big is the Uber empire at this point?
Yeah, I mean, Uber and the ride-hail industry have only been around for the last 5 years, and people forget that. But it's a huge feat for a company that has pioneered the ride-hail industry and has disrupted a deeply entrenched incumbent taxi industry that regulators everywhere once thought was illegal, to successfully fought to become legal in many and most major jurisdictions in the United States. And it serves millions of people across the United States, and according to the company, last I checked, Uber serves 55% of the population in the country.
And what about internationally at this point, Johanna?
Yeah, I mean, that's like where the biggest battle is left to fight for Uber. Uber is trying to go into new markets where local players who are doing exactly what Uber is doing and control the market in much the same way Uber controls the market in the U.S. have already cornered those new markets. But Uber still does have a presence in more than 300 cities across the world.
54 countries, I'm reading here in one of your stories,
yes.
170 cities domestically, hundreds more internationally, and a treasure chest with billions in it. How much has Uber raised now at this point?
It's raised more than $2 million, but it's valued at $41
billion. $2 billion. I've got $5 billion here. I don't know. Lots and lots. They're loaded
yeah.
for bear, and they're moving beyond just rides. There's Uber Eats here. They'll pick up restaurant food and bring it to your house as well.
Yeah, I mean, they will do anything that is on demand, and that's like the biggest part of it. They won't do anything that will require them to go out of their way to get something for the customers, but they will do anything that is easy enough for them to pick up in a matter of seconds. And like that sound clip said, Travis really focuses on things that will be reliable and they can get to you within 2 to 3 or at least at most 5 minutes.
Travis, the CEO of Uber, and they are disruptors here. Currently, they're using freelance drivers, but they're all looking to go right beyond that. Page one of the Wall Street Journal today, they just hired away, just poached almost the entire top robotics research team out of Carnegie Mellon University.
No.
Uber just snapped it up.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that's been going on for a while. It's a partnership, according to Carnegie Mellon. But before that partnership happened, Uber poached a lot of their top staffers. And then I think, you know, according to reports and according to sources who have also spoken to me, Carnegie Mellon was forced into a partnership almost.
Some partnership. But the yeah. vision there is, I mean, right now they use all these so-called contract drivers, freelancers.
Right.
But Uber envisions itself being at the forefront of autonomous self-driving cars, no person involved.
Yeah, and that's an issue that a lot of drivers take, particularly drivers who are not happy with the rates that Uber has for drivers right now. They got into the industry and they joined Uber because it was a better opportunity than taxi driving in many cities and many markets. But as soon as Uber was able to cultivate a driver base and then also cultivate a demand for those drivers, they lowered the rates and continue to lower the rates. And drivers are unhappy. And one thing that they trot out often is a quote from Travis Kalanick, basically said that, in the end, his end goal is to have driverless cars, meaning drivers are not important to him, and then that's how drivers have interpreted it.
Your headline is, it's already over, Uber's won. Is there any chance that old players are going to push back here and somehow turn this around, taxi companies and the rest, say no thank you?
In the United States, there are a few jurisdictions where taxi companies are still holding strong and are still fighting Uber off, like Las Vegas. Boise is another place where, taxi players have pushed Uber out, and they have left. But the larger play is that they will leave the smaller cities and smaller jurisdictions and go to the state level and try to fight for a statewide jurisdiction. So, even if they're leaving cities, it's very rarely them relinquishing control of that market.
Jana Bouillon covers Uber and much more in the transportation area when it comes to on-demand economy. Johanna is with BuzzFeed News, joined us from San Francisco. Johanna, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Let's hop across the country to New York and Arun Sundarajan. He's professor of information operations management sciences at New York University's Stern School of Business. Arun, thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be here, Tom.
Give us a sense of just how widely and how many fields we're now looking at on-demand apps on smartphones across the country, around the world, Arun.
It's really proliferating. It has really proliferated over the last 5 years. Apart from Uber, it started with Uber and its competitors, Lyft and Sidecar. You've got a company called BlaBlaCar that isn't in the United States but is in 50 other countries, primarily France and Germany, where you can, on-demand, get a ride from one city to another city. There's a wide range of generic delivery services. Postmates will pick anything up for you. Deliv sort of does this, but business to business. Uber themselves does it. Specialized services like Munchery that'll deliver meals, or Sprig that'll deliver meals. Then there are companies that will ship your stuff. The most popular one is Shipt, spelled with a Y, where you simply take a picture of what you want delivered. I used it recently. I just sort of spread stuff on my floor. I took a picture. A few minutes later, someone came. They sort of packed it up and they shipped it off to where I wanted it to go. So it's incredibly convenient. There's a wide range of generic personal services, in a sense. TaskRabbit, which offers you a wide range of, like, plumbers, electricians, home cleaning, stand in the line for me at the DMV. More specialized ones like HomeJoy and Handy that are primarily on home services, JobRunner on professional services. And now we're seeing the emergence of a bunch of services that I don't think are going to sort of be displaced by Uber's investments in robotics, like Zeal that offers massage on demand, Heal that offers doctors on demand, Saucy and Drizzly alcohol on demand. There's even one called Ease that will deliver your medical marijuana to you. There's Washio that will come and do your laundry. There is Alfred that, sends you sort of a personal concierge. There's Lux that, you tell them where you're going 10 minutes in advance and a personal valet will come and park your car for you and then bring it back for you when you need it.
It's an unbelievable range. Unbelievable.
And it really is. And, in some ways, when I first started seeing the proliferation of these services, I was reminded of a company called Cosmo that emerged 15 years ago that basically promised you anything delivered in an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And Cosmo was sort of launched at the height of the dot-com bubble back in the late 1990s. And they went out of business. And part of the reason why they did and why these services are emerging now is that we've got this on-demand workforce. We've got people who have GPS-enabled smartphones, both on the side of the people who are providing the services and on the side of the customers. And so you don't have to equip a specialized workforce with those kinds of devices that your UPS drivers have. you know, your phone becomes your connection to this platform.
Which means you can have a whole army of people just floating around waiting to park your car. It's kind of unbelievable. I mean, this is the kind of service that only the rich and famous had at one time. Butlers and maids and footmen and servants. And now we have a workforce that's technologically empowered and maybe economically disempowered. So they're ready and willing to stand by to park your car.
Yeah, I agree with the technologically empowered. I think on the economically disempowered, it's sort of an open question. I think for some of these workers, it will be empowering. For some, perhaps not. But you're absolutely right. I mean, we're democratizing access to a higher standard of living in some sense. I mean, that's, I think, how a lot of people first felt when they started using Uber, you know, sort of black car on demand. This is not something
snap
that
your
was
fingers and there's
life.
The limo. Yeah.
Yeah. And now it's sort of extended to sort of a whole slew of other slices of our lives.
Is it really democratizing or is it just dividing into bigger camps? Those who will be standing around waiting to hop to and do whatever you need and those with the means to hire them?
Again, Tom, I think that remains to be seen. I think I do hear the narrative of, you know, the race to the bottom, where we're going to have like one segment of the population that are consumers of these services and a much larger fraction who are sort of scraping by on sort of smartphone-enabled piecework.
On the other hand, Uber can be pretty cheap sometimes, you know, compared to...
Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Uber for everything economy. All kinds of on-demand services are popping up with apps attached. Just point and it's done. Click and in it comes for washing your laundry, for giving you a back rub, for shipping your packages, for parking your car. Never mind giving you a ride if that's what you want, Uber style. And the conversation going on that ultimately this could have deep, deep effects on the shape of our economy, of labor, of how capital flows, of how we live. Arun Sundararajan joins us from NYU's Stern School of Business. All kinds of options out there. Back in April, CBS News reporter Rita Braver reported on the concierge economy, or the on-demand economy. Here she tried out a new app called Fetch Coffee.
I could start my day by getting Fetch Coffee to bring me my favorite brew. I can even ask for skim milk, and they say they'll be here in an hour. Wow. Soon, Tony Chen, who's starting the service in parts of D.C., showed up with a latte for $3 over the store price.
Perfect. Thank you.
Boom. $3 over the store price, and it's in your home. Maybe you want something like yoga. Here also, CBS News talks to Kelly Glass in Washington, D.C., about why she and her husband prefer to hit the app, order a yoga class in their own living room.
30 minutes to go wherever you're going to go and get ready, and then it's an hour workout, and then it's a rest to get home and change and shower.
Where's it going to go? It could go almost anywhere, maybe up in the air. A year ago, a Bay Area startup announced the launch of an app called Gopher, offering drones on demand. So far, the app hasn't rolled out. It's kind of a thought experiment, but we're doing thought experiments today. This whole world is rushing forward. You could order your drone to check out a restaurant, to see if your friends are out on the deck there having dinner, fly ahead of you on the highway to look for speed traps. But wait, there's more. Here's part of Gopher's ad.
With Gopher, drones on demand are the future. Using our mobile app, you can task a drone to provide you a multitude of services. Why settle for mediocre selfies when you can have a drone take HD photos and videos of your adventures? Or if you're walking in an unsafe neighborhood, why not have a drone follow you and find the least risky way back? Gopher is the future of consumer drone technology. Our initial release is limited to 5 cities in the United States. Sign up today at gopherdrones.com.
Drones on demand, coming soon, perhaps, to your backyard. Arun Sundararajan, please stand by in New York. With us right now from Los Angeles is Chris Vaughn. Chris is CEO and founder of Saucy. It's the app that delivers alcohol and other ingredients for cocktails to the consumer anywhere. Its slogan is, it's always 5 p.m. Your favorite beer, wine, spirits delivered in under an hour. Chris Vaughn, thank you for joining us.
Tom, thanks for having me.
Chris, there are liquor stores everywhere. Who needs this?
Well, I think that there was a huge proliferation of liquor stores over the years because it's a very easy business to make money with, right? Typically, you open a store, you open the doors in the morning, and you sort of magically make sales of alcohol. It's always been that way. You haven't really had to establish a brand or do a lot of marketing, and that's why you see this huge proliferation of liquor stores.
Yeah.
You take, for example, a market like Los Angeles. We have over 3,000 places you can buy alcoholic beverages from. And I think that that's where you see major players like BevMo and Total Wine and sort of these huge, huge big box people came in maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago and said, hey, there is an over proliferation of these stores. We can provide a better shopping experience with actually, you know, personalized shopping and all these types of things by coming to our store. And the way that we fundamentally view Saucy is, and the on-demand economy in many ways, there's two types of services. There's ones that are purely convenience-based,
mm-hmm.
and then there are others that are actually replacing sort of your buying behavior or improving your shopping experience.
So are you talking about this going from mom-and-pa retail to big box to, with Saucy and its ilk, ultimately no box, Chris Vaughn? I mean, we know how much big box changed the American economy. Do you guys take us into no box future?
Well, I think if you look at something like, you know, Amazon and what Amazon did with books, right, is you did have sort of small mom-and-pop bookstores, and then you moved into Barnes & Noble and all these types of stores. And then Amazon came along, and realistically, they just had better shopping tools. And sort of the key to that is actually something that Uber said, right, is you have to be 100% reliable, right? Would Amazon have sort of come in and done, you know, what it did to Barnes & Noble if I ordered a book and it showed up 3, 4, 5 weeks after they said it would, or it didn't show up sometimes, or whatever it may be.
So right. Let's say you're totally reliable with your booze delivery. Does that mean that liquor stores 10 years from now are kind of antique?
Well, I think that we the way that Saucy works is we partner with retail stores in any city that we work with, right? That has to do with how licensing works mm-hmm. and how order processing has to work, particular to alcohol. It's fundamentally very different than a lot of other delivery services in the way that it has to work to be in compliance with the law. So we partner with retailers throughout a given market, and when a customer places an order, they're placing an order with that local retailer, and then the closest Saucy courier is picking it up and bringing it to the customer. However, you know, if you have a Saucy experience that's tailored to your purchasing behavior, it's building recommendations and showing you products based on everything that you've bought in the past, you know, that's fundamentally a better shopping experience than if you went into a store and you're just staring at a shelf of a whole bunch of bottles.
Right? Not to mention that you're prepared to go very concierge if your customer wants it, right? That your people will actually come and mix the drinks.
Well, we have done promotions where you can order sort of an on-demand bartender that's going to come and teach you how to be a mixologist in your home. Or we've done an activation with Absolut with Pernod Ricard where you could order sort of a cocktail package and it came with all the ingredients and a bartender would show you how to cut the limes and do everything the way that you would dream that you could at a bar or restaurant. But I think when you look at the overall landscape of these apps, again, it comes back to, is it just convenience, or is it something that's fundamentally changing the way that we shop in that industry today? You know, Uber has done that so well with transportation because they have provided fundamentally just a better service. You know, cabs and riding in cabs, probably a big part of that is I can't rate my driver, and subsequently the experience hasn't been great all these years. You know, something like massages or laundry or whatever it may be, I'd argue that's a little bit more of a convenience, right? Is it that much better to have a massage in my home than going to a spa? Maybe, maybe not, right? Laundry, is it that much more difficult for me to put the clothes in the washer in my house or to drop it off at the dry cleaner downstairs? Maybe, maybe not. But I think what we're doing with alcohol is we have unbelievable amounts of new data around consumer drinking behaviors that a lot of brands and companies have never had access to before. We're able to provide a better shopping experience than if you went out to the retailer, and it's something that is tailored based on your purchasing behavior. And, you know, it's something where it's fundamentally an impulsive behavior. You want to have a drink, you want to have a beer. You know, I kind of joke, I say nobody says, oh man, I wish I could have a beer next Thursday after work. No, they say, hey, we would like to have some beers right now. So we fit right into the culmination of all those different things.
Chris Vaughn, CEO and founder of Saucy, with us from LA there. Their slogan, it's always 5 p.m. Your favorite beer, wine, spirits delivered in under an hour. Chris, good luck. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
Arun, I've got to get you on this. Listen here, it has come first and biggest to transportation, and of course it's disrupted things there. We'll see what comes down the road, but here's a little bit of sound of unhappy taxi drivers. Here's one in Boston talking with WBUR, my home station.
I do not want any ex-Uber is coming over here stealing our jobs because I cannot afford to pay my taxi mortgage. I cannot afford to pay my rent.
And here in Toronto, in Canada, when Uber came to town, taxi drivers left their parked cars in the streets around City Hall, snarling downtown traffic.
Uber is down! Down, down, down!
Uber service down, 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 down. Arun, how much disruption do you see coming to the economy as we know it from the on-demand onslaught?
I think that the reaction of the taxi drivers and the kind of disruption that we've seen in sort of point-to-point urban transportation is probably unique in certain ways because when Uber and Lyft and Sidecar came along, they offered a much better product than what was out there in pretty much every city in the United States. And so they took on an industry where the product was fundamentally inferior to what they were offering. And so you'd expect that over the next 5 years, except maybe in Las Vegas and New York City in the United States, you're going to see that industry, point-to-point urban transportation, be almost exclusively app-driven. In other industries, I think the changes will be more gradual and more measured. For example, this isn't on demand, but Airbnb is certainly impacting the hotel industry. But, in the long run, both will coexist. Hotels will serve a certain market. Airbnb will serve a certain market. I think in on-demand retailing, it's still an open question. And just building on, the conversation with Saucy, there's a very real chance that in a lot of retail sectors, what we're going to see local retail become is sort of like a glorified warehouse where, there's an app called Instacart, which will get you someone to go to your local grocery store, buy your groceries for you as you want and sort of bring them to you in an hour.
Yeah.
And, as they scale and as these other specialized services scale, what may end up happening is that the local retailer becomes the place where stuff is stored close to where you live.
Mm-hmm.
The app becomes the sort of the point where the merchandising, the customer relationship management, the recommendations, all of those come. And so the analogy with Amazon is good in certain ways. I think Amazon has had the same kind of effect on the mail order business, where you sort of go to Amazon rather than mail ordering, and the mail order people sell through Amazon. And so in a similar way, you might start to see more and more local retailers get more and more dependent on apps like Instacart and Saucy and Drizzly and some of these others.
And maybe one day storefronts become less common. Consumers get more accustomed to living like dukes and duchesses where people bring them what they want. How far into the economy could that go? Hard to say. Larry in Nashville, Tennessee is calling. Larry, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah. What's your story?
I'm fascinated by the application of these approaches to delivering all kinds of services. You may not be aware that there's a retail law firm in Palo Alto, which is a storefront, the purpose of which is to provide legal services to clients of all types in a much more predictable and much less costly fashion. And the work that's being done in legal services delivery is really disrupting an industry that is not prepared for putting clients first and giving them the option of price certainty, while at the same time providing lawyers who provide services to an underserved market. 4 out of 5 individuals and businesses in the U.S. today go it alone rather than entail the cost and the inconvenience of consulting with a lawyer.
Larry, are you saying I'm going to have an app on my smartphone? I click and suddenly I've got a lawyer's face pops up on my phone or a lawyer at my front door?
Well, it's virtually available to you by virtue of the capacity of technology. There are a number of providers of legal services that contract with individuals who are made available to clients, corporate and individual, simply by the virtual capacity of technology to connect to at much less cost and at far greater efficiency.
It's going to make it cheaper for consumers. Is it going to drive down lawyers' incomes then? Are they going to be lined up to drive Uber cars instead?
Well, they will be lined up to provide better, faster, cheaper, and more profitably once they understand the value proposition of delivering legal services efficiently.
Larry, I appreciate your call. Larry in Nashville sees all this coming to the legal industry. The lawyers, watch out, or maybe line up. Maybe you're next in line. Arun Sundarajan, please stand by in New York. With us right now from London, Adrian Woolridge, managing editor and columnist at The Economist, author of the new book out tomorrow called The Great Disruption, How Business is Coping with Turbulent Times. Adrian Woolridge, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So what do you see coming in this? You're writing about the Great Disruption. Is this it? The on-demand economy?
This is a huge disruption, and it's a disruption that's starting off, as it were, in the physical economy with things like Uber, things like the delivery of drink and food, but is also going to permeate right the way through the knowledge economy as well, the sort of jobs that perhaps you and I do, the sort of jobs that lawyers do, the sort of jobs that consultants do. We're at the very beginning of a huge disruption of the economy, which is changing what it means to be a worker, the nature of work, and it's changing the meaning of the term corporation. It's changing what it means to be a corporation. So the basic building blocks of capitalism are being revolutionized by the on-demand economy.
We've spoken a bit about what it means to be a worker, how that may change. We'll look more at that. What do you mean it could change the meaning of a corporation and its role or function?
Well, corporations used to employ people and they used to own assets. In this new economy, they will not employ people and they won't really own any assets at all. Uber doesn't employ any taxi drivers or drivers, it doesn't really own any of these cars. It acts as a maker of markets, a maker of contracts between individuals who want to be taken somewhere and people who want to take them somewhere. So the company becomes really an intermediary which owns as little as it possibly can. And that's an absolute reversal of what companies were all about in the early part of the 20th century.
Does this lead to a healthier economy, whatever that means? We like to think of it as employment, shared fruits, better quality of life for most or all.
That's an incredibly difficult question to answer. It leads to a much more fluid economy. It brings extraordinary numbers of benefits to consumers, people who want to be driven in a taxi. I mean, taxis basically provided a really bad service in the past. Now you have an option of a much better service for perhaps the same price, perhaps less, certainly not much more. But it creates all sorts of problems. It creates problems for individuals to plan their lives. It creates a great deal of uncertainty from the point of view of producers. And I think it creates huge uncertainty for economies in general. You know, the economies, particularly the American economy, are built upon a notion of companies providing employment, companies providing healthcare, pension plans and things like that. And all that is very, very rapidly eroding. So policymakers really have to take this on board or you will see the basis of the fiscal state being destroyed before your eyes.
Arun, do you think it can really roll across the country, roll around the world? Some people say, well, yeah, this will happen in Silicon Valley and New York and L.A. and popping big cities, but not everywhere.
It'll certainly have deeper effects in the densely populated urban areas. And that's because on-demand is just sort of better suited when you have lots of people together and the person who you are getting on-demand is closer by. But over time, it'll certainly permeate the broader economy and it raises a lot of questions about the safety net, as Adrian pointed out.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. Thank you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Uber for everything economy, all kinds of on-demand services, apps, what they mean for workers, for capitalism, for you, for life, for the economy in the U.S. and well beyond. Adrian Wooldridge is with us from London. He's edits a management column, writes a column at The Economist. He's author of the new book, The Great Disruption, How Business is Coping with Turbulent Times. Arun Sundararajan is with us from the Stern School of Business at NYU in New York. Here's a promotional video for Washio. It's kind of an Uber for your laundry and dry cleaning. Currently operates in L.A., San Francisco, Chicago, Washington, Boston, more. Here's an interview with what Washio calls their ninjas, a Washio ninja. She does the wash. She's in L.A. Her name is Allison. She's excited about it.
My name is Allison Marietson. I'm from Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I'm a Washio ninja. The company morale at Washio is just to be enthusiastic and amazing customer service. I think just the nature of the job in general is a very different dynamic than, you know, normal work life. So I decided to become a little bit more of a hustler, if you will.
Hustler doing the laundry. I don't know. You can put jazzy music in there, but it's still doing the laundry in the end. Some Uber drivers not so sure. In January this year, here's one in Atlanta, Georgia. Brian Newell quit his job. He had quit his job because he made more money working for Uber. But then Uber decided to reduce fares from $1.75 a mile to 95 cents a mile. And here's Newell talking with CBS News from the driver's seat of his car. Not so happy now.
We're delivering, you know, Ritz-Carlton-like service, but we're getting Motel 6 type rates. 10 trips used to earn me maybe $125 to $150. Now 10 trips usually grosses about $85.
Yeah, and he's not happy about that. Adrian Wooldridge, over time, what does it likely mean for compensation for labor? Does it hold up? Does it get stronger because people are out hustling their own way? Does it weaken because you're sort of competing with anybody who jumps any time into the labor pool?
Well, I would think that the impact is to reduce unit labor costs, basically. I mean, it has a huge impact on people like taxi drivers. It will definitely make them force them to operate in a much more competitive environment. But I also think it's got a big impact for people like consultants and lawyers who are really charging quite a lot for their services. And I think you'll get very big pressure to automate a lot of those services or contract them out or Uberize them in various ways. So I can see that some of the coziest of professions like lawyers and consultants will be under huge price pressure. So a hard time for workers in general. On the other hand, if you're the sort of worker who wants to work part-time, who wants a flexible contract, who doesn't want to be committed for life to a consultancy and be a sort of wage slave to that consultancy, it gives workers also more control over their time. So you win some and you definitely lose some.
Control over your time, but you still got to make a living. Arun, I'll bring it to you. Let me get a couple people out there looking at this. In Craig in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Craig, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay. What do you see, Craig?
Hello?
Hello. You're on, Craig.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I'm thinking that one perspective on this whole scenario is that Uber Vacation is a socialism phenomena, an equalization phenomena, counteracting what the 1% did, and that is they got a lot of their money already out of the Internet. And now it's everybody else's turn. In other words, the 99%, it's their turn to get money out of the Internet. And so fair is fair, if you get what I mean.
I do. Let me put it to my guest, Craig. Arun, how about it? It's time for the 99%, the little guy, to get their piece of Internet profit. Is that what you see coming here, Arun?
I think Craig has a point, but I think it's going to depend on the industry. I think for lawyers and consultants and some of those professional services, probably average prices that we pay will go down. But it's not clear that the money that is kept by the lawyer or the consultant is going to go down. And I think there's going to be a lot of equalizing where, you know, instead of having, you know, a few $1,000 lawyers and a few, like, you know, $100 lawyers, the wages will become sort of a lot more equal. I certainly see a lot of empowerment in certain sectors. People who sell on Etsy, people who drive on Lyft, they're sort of able to pursue some of the other things that they want in their lives, they sort of often see it as empowering rather than a race to the bottom. And so there's definitely, you know, this isn't completely new. I think that when Google came along, and sure, Google is worth hundreds of billions of dollars, but Google has also empowered hundreds of thousands or maybe millions of website owners to make a living by selling advertising through their websites. And so in a similar way, you see Uber empowering certain drivers who now get a loan, buy a car, and become micro-entrepreneurs. But, you know, I think that for professions where, like, you know, the status quo used to be a comfortable full-time job with health insurance and benefits and so on, there's probably going to be some pressure, and we really do have to think about how we're going to build the new safety net for this workforce, which is, by all sort of like, you know, projections, in a decade going to be more than 50% freelance.
50% of the American workforce freelancing? Is that what you just described, Arun? That's the future?
Yep. I mean, at this point, it's already 20% who exclusively freelance and another 10 or 15% who are sort of moonlighting. That number is bound to grow. And, you know, we've built an economy, as Adrian pointed out, where a lot of the safety net is tied to some notion of full-time employment with a company or with the government. And so we've got to sort of think about ways in which we can invent structures like the 401k plan, which took what used to be a corporate pension plan and converted it into some sort of partnership between the individual, the marketplace, and the government. You know, the individual contributes, the company sometimes matches, and the government gives you a tax break. And so, but yeah, there's definitely going to be a lot less income stability over time, and we're going to have to adapt, and perhaps with the help of some new products, figure out a way to sort of, you know, maintain the same high standard of living that we've constructed over the last century. We don't want that to slip away. And there's definitely sort of a big role that the government has to play and a big role that the platforms have to play.
Of course, a lot has slipped already. I mean, Adrian, our listeners are listening to this, and, you know, some are just dazzled by the idea of things you can just punch into your smartphone and services you can have in a nanosecond. Others worried about what it means. Paul Wright says it's race to the bottom, floating slave workforce in the land of the greedy, just waiting around to fan the pharaohs. Uberization is a clear sign of impoverishment. You know, Adrian, I used to live in India, and you could get just about any service. You could hire someone to do almost anything, anytime, because people desperately needed the work. I mean, I wonder if this whole on-demand economy has emerged in the last decade in the first place because it coincided, yes, with technology, but also with unemployment and so much pressure on working people to get some kind of work.
Absolutely. I think it's come at a time when the freelance economy already basically exists because people have been losing their permanent jobs. They're desperate to find something. So what these platforms do is to try and bring some order and efficiency to something that already exists. There are plenty of people out there to supply the workforce. But it, you know, it's very, very mixed. On the one hand, if you're a consumer, what you've been saying earlier about people living like kings or queens, there's some truth in that. You can get your washing done, you can get your food delivered, you can get your martini made. So you gain in that sense. I think if you're a student, you can supplement your income in an incredibly efficient way. If you're a micro entrepreneur who, you know, invests in their car and really wants to be driving around, that's a great freedom that you have, which used to be restricted by all sorts of cartel-like arrangements. However, if you're a middle-aged man or woman with a family to support, bills to pay, a mortgage to pay, you're suddenly projected into a much, much more uncertain world. So there are winners, there are huge losers. And as we've said, but I think we need to really emphasize this point, we need to redesign social policy to deal with a very, very different world. And that's a particularly big problem, strangely enough, in the United States, because the United States, since the Second World War, has got into the habit of providing a lot of its welfare state, a lot of its security through companies. And these companies are rapidly dissolving or offloading all sorts of functions from themselves. So we need to create a system, either by the state taking more responsibility or by individuals taking more responsibility, or you're going to end up with a lot of retirees with no pensions and a lot of sick people with no healthcare. So it's a real public policy issue that needs to be urgently addressed.
That is interesting. You sort of pointing, I guess, in a way, it's Northern Europe, perhaps social welfare states, stronger social welfare states, they may be more structurally ready for this economy because they didn't shift so much to the corporations. So already the government playing that role.
Absolutely. No, the American situation is a very peculiar one, and it was an artifact of an era when you had big companies and big trade unions and a fairly stable economy. And that word is dissolving. So you can go in one of two directions. You can either go in the direction of the state taking more responsibility, or you can go in the direction of the individual taking more responsibility. But the status quo is unsustainable. And paradoxically, Europe, with a bigger role for the state, is actually in some ways better positioned to adjust itself to this much more flexible, fluid economy. And again, Obamacare, which has been obviously derided by conservatives, is actually in many ways a step towards adjusting to an economy where you're not going to be working for the same company and you're not going to be getting corporate benefits all your life.
Let's go to Melinda. Oh, yes, Arun, please.
There's actually probably a third way as well, mm-hmm. which is, sort of government policy that delegates more of this responsibility to the platforms that are aggregating these freelancers. I mean, in some ways, we're seeing the corporations dissolve, but we're seeing these giant platforms emerge. Today, they're privately owned shareholder corporations. And if we sort out the confusion between being a full-time employee and being a contractor and sort of get that categorization right, mm-hmm. we might start to see some of the platforms step up and start to offer some of these benefits as retention mechanisms. I could fully see Lyft, for example, offering benefits to their drivers to prevent them from switching to Uber. And so that's the market working to provide some of this safety net. I've also started to see some dedicated platforms emerge for the provision of the safety net itself. There's an organization called Peers based in San Francisco that will offer you different forms of health insurance and workers' compensation insurance. That points to sort of Adrian's path of the individual taking greater responsibility. But it's not inconceivable that in the near future, either if these platforms remain sort of privately owned, or if the drivers sort of band together, for example, on Uber and say, we don't like the status quo, we're going to form a cooperative and sort of switch New York to a cooperatively owned system, that this collective somehow sort of starts to shoulder some of that responsibility as well.
It's hard to imagine that Uber, after raising all those investor billions, is not going to work pretty hard to stay privately owned. But Adrian, what about these big corporations or platforms, as Arun calls them? Are they going to behave in this way? I mean, after all, they are so different. I'm reading here, Tom Goodwin wrote in TechCrunch a couple of months ago saying, Uber, the world's largest taxi company, owns no vehicles. Facebook, the world's most popular media owner, creates no content. Alibaba, the world's most valuable retailer, has no inventory. Airbnb, the world's largest accommodation provider, owns no real estate. Something interesting is happening. Interesting indeed. Do you foresee that they will act in the kind of, in the manner of American corporations, in a way, of the 20th century, and take some responsibility along broader lines for their employees, their contract labor, Adrian?
Well, the short answer is no. They'll try and do as little as possible to do that. I think if you go back to the early 20th century, U.S. Steel employed 250,000 workers. It employed more people than the Army and the Navy combined. You know, companies in that era wanted to be big. They wanted to employ a lot of people. They wanted to own a lot of stuff. And you have exactly the opposite dynamic going on in capitalism today. Companies want to own as little as possible. They want to employ as few people as possible. They want to get down to zero if possible. It's the capitalism of nothing, as it were. They want to be just an algorithm which creates efficient spot markets in talent. They want nothing. And if you've got nothing, if you've got no long-term commitments, that means that you are flexible, you're sleek, you can adjust to these extraordinary turbulent times. So it may be the case that if you get tight labor markets, they will be obliged to give more things to their workers in order to retain them. But I suspect that the ideal situation is to have zero commitments to people and to the long term.
And what about assets? Are they, in a way, living off assets accumulated in the old economy, Adrian? I mean, there's lots of vehicles out there and everything else. You say they want nothing. Does that work long term?
They don't want to have any vehicles, because what they basically want to do is to arrange contracts between between workers and people who have vehicles. So what they're doing is employing spare capacity as efficiently as possible. So you've got a spare room, you've got a spare car, you've got spare time. These companies will act as market makers. And that's a great position for them to be in.
I mean, but all those rooms were built under a certain kind of economy. This is a different kind of economy. Does it keep building? Does it keep creating new assets for the future?
Yes, but I don't think the companies themselves want to do that, because why build a hotel when you can turn other people's rooms into your own hotel? And if you have an economy with huge degrees of uncertainty, huge degrees of volatility, you want to reduce your commitments as much as possible, because that gives you a lot of operating room. The one counter argument to what I'm saying is what is actually Uber is looking at the moment, and that is driverless cars. In that case, they would have to go into the car owning business. They would be changing their business model from being a sort of a spot market in talent to being car owners.
It sounds like a present and certainly future in which we're all going to have to be very, very zen to flow through all this marvelous fluidity, if indeed it's marvelous. Wonderful, eye-opening insights. Adrian Wooldridge is author of the new book out tomorrow, The Great Disruption, How Business is Coping with Turbulent Times. Writes for The Economist, joined us from London. Adrian, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Arun Sundarrajan, Professor of Information Operations and Management Sciences at NYU's Stern School of Business. Arun, wonderful to have you with us. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Tom. Always great to join you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.